The following is a First Marine Aircraft Wing taped historical interview. Interviewee is First Lieutenant James M. Alexander, 094504 USMCR. Air Support Control Officer attached to MAS 3 MACG 18, Chulai, Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Corporal Norman R. Carlson, 218-5474, USMC. This interview takes place at Chulai, Republic of Vietnam on 26 April 1968. The subject of this interview is operational differences of ASRAT and Quezon occurring from February 27, 1968 to April 2, 1968. This interview is classified secret until downgraded by higher authority.
I'm First Lieutenant James M. Alexander, attached to MAS 3, Republic of Vietnam. From February 27th to April 2nd, 1968, as OIC of ASRAT Bravo, which was located at Quezon at this time. Once arriving at Quezon, I was presented with quite a few different problems and procedures that we had at other areas in Vietnam. And due to the hardship and demands on the set at the time, there was not time for adequate maintenance on the set as is required in other areas where we have more time to operate. Our working through FFCC is quite a bit different than the procedures used other places. Normally our targets are not given to us over the phone or any other way except in emergency circumstances unless we have a signed hardback copy. Due to the circumstances at Quezon at that time, these are targets mainly are almost exclusively over Lima through the DASC. FFCC would receive targets, clear them, pass them through the DASC onto us within a matter of a few minutes of receiving them. Work them, double check them, read them back, and sometimes in a matter of 5 to 10 minutes after receiving a target from FFCC. Normally we'd run one-run salvos with all aircraft, and when we first arrived there, over 50% of our missions were flights of two or more, sometimes as many as a flight of 14 or 16. We had quite a bit of problems there with the maintenance. We normally, if we were lucky, got 1 hour a day for maintenance unless some serious problems arise. We were operating the set for the first 4 weeks I was there, 23 hours a day, with little or no pause between aircraft. We had quite a bit of trouble with our radar. It wasn't too well protected from shrapnel. It was almost every day or every other day there was more shrapnel in the radar, but we were fairly fortunate with our radar at this time. It seemed to perform better under the hardships of Quezon than it did down at the relative safety and laxity of Chulai. We had extremely proficient techs that kept us set up, did everything they had to. We had people working under fire. We had problems with our radar. We used a ARC 52 as our primary when we first arrived and had problems with the radios going down constantly and having to be replaced. So then we switched to a GRC 48 for our primary radio and switched over to 52s for a backup. We occasionally ran into problems with our antennas being knocked down by shrapnel, and so we moved the 52 antenna directly above our bunker and a GRC 48 antenna approximately 100 meters away. Therefore, we could, if one antenna was knocked out or one radio went out, we could switch within a few seconds pause between radios, therefore not losing any comm. We ran across probably the first pair of drops in Vietnam at Quezon with ASRAT Bravo. We tried the method taught to us in our technical literature. We tried the method suggested by the Air Force. The method we worked at Quezon, which worked fairly well, was that we would try to line the aircraft up the long axis of the runway and give them a mark on the end of the runway, and they would use a stopwatch from there, figuring their own cart, which did not concern us. The main reason for using this instead of the normal procedure for paradrops is our location of this radar, which is approximately 300 meters from the runway, and it was almost impossible for the radar to keep lock on the aircraft for the paradrops using the normal procedure. We also had experience sometimes with GCA, which at best was very minimal, which was used in extreme emergencies that would work. The weather wasn't too bad. We did not like to rely upon this for GCA. We had problems keeping our generators up. We had good generators, about the best in our whole squadron. We had good people working on them, but there's constantly having to worry about shrapnel hitting them. We dug them in fairly well, and this was solved. We had two 400 cycle generators and one 60 cycle generator. We were trying to go completely 400 cycle using our ARC 52 and 400 cycle train air conditioner to get rid of the 60 cycle. But as it was up there, our train air conditioner, the one we had, went out, and we had to rely upon 60 cycle air conditioners. And we also used a GRC 48, which is 60 cycle, so therefore we needed two generators at all times. If a 60 cycle generator went out, we could switch over to the ARC 52s for our radio, but we could not operate more than a few hours without the set becoming erratic because of the extreme heat in the bunker without air conditioners. We bombed in Laos quite a bit, which took approximately 5 to 10 minutes clearance, more than our other targets in North Vietnam, South Vietnam and the DMZ. We'd have to go to the Air Force to get clearance for all targets in Laos. Sometimes we had extremely good targets there, we spotted, we could not drop on for some reason. Normally we had a spotter working with us, we dropped in Laos. We dropped in the DMZ rarely. When we did, we'd use it for a free drop zone. Normally when we were too busy on aircraft, we'd either give them a tack and to drop on at least 10 miles from the closest friendly, or just track them until they're roughly over the free drop zone. We did not drop in the North Vietnam while I was OIC at this detachment. We were covered from Dong Ha by the two ASRATs there, and on rare occasions when we went down, our load could be taken over by the Air Force and the ASRATs at Dong Ha. This doesn't seem to work too well because of the range difficulties and that most of the beacons, birds, only beacon birds could reach our targets around Khe Sanh from Dong Ha. We are averaging over 100 missions a day for the first 3 to 4 weeks that I was at Khe Sanh. Then things start slacking off. As the Air Force started taking more and more control of our operation procedures, we received less and less birds. During Operation Crusher, which was supposedly a large air attack, massive air attack for a 24-hour period against the North Vietnamese, we received less aircraft than we did under normal operating procedure. So in our respect, this did not help us at all up there. We were averaging anywhere from 8 to 15 secondary explosions a day. We worked with a spotter at least twice a week, and this kept us from having to use a calibration hop, which we normally do under normal circumstances. Under extremely difficult targets with a lot of 50 caliber and 37 millimeter anti-aircraft guns, they would use TPQ-10 during the day because of the danger to close air support. We adjusted our drops very similar to the artillery, and we had quite good results this way. Occasionally, we would have people spot from the ground for us, especially when we're dropping close to the perimeter at Khe Sanh or Hill 881. We have received targets as close as 100 meters from friendlies, and 300 to 500 meters from friendlies was fairly common when we first arrived at Khe Sanh.
The following is a 1st Marine Aircraft Wing taped historical interview. The interviewee is Major William J. Sullivan, 062427, USMC, Executive Officer of MAS-3, MACG-18, Chu Lai, Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Corporal Norman R. Carlson, 218-5474, USMC. This interview takes place at Chu Lai, Republic of Vietnam on 26 April 1968. The subject of this interview is MAS-3 operations at Khe Sanh, occurring from 15 January 1968 to 10 April 1968. This interview is classified secret until downgraded by higher authority.
W.J. Sullivan, Executive Officer of Marine Air Support Squadron 3, Republic of Vietnam. On 15 January 1968, the squadron was ordered to move its ASRAT Bravo from Chu Lai to Khe Sanh. On 16 January, the move was made, and on 20 January, we commenced operations at Khe Sanh. The same day, we were ordered to establish a direct air support center at Khe Sanh. We moved on 21 and 22 January and commenced operations at Khe Sanh on 23 January. Since our unit is organized only to operate one direct air support center, and this made the third, considerable support was required from other units in communication gear, generators, and communication personnel. Prior to 5 February, the weather was generally good at Khe Sanh, and the DASC usually had available up to 7 forward air controllers, both airborne and ground. A routine soon developed as operations continued. During daylight hours, 3 Air Force and 2 Marine tactical air controllers airborne were usually on the scene and were kept supplied with fixed-wing aircraft using both Air Force and Marine sources. In addition, an Air Force Airborne Command and Control Center was always available, working directly with the DASC. The ABCCC was utilized for unusual or complicated situations and resulted in excellent coordination. Early in the month, the communications section that had been attached from the 1st Marine Air Wing installed a switchboard, which primarily served the DASC, but also tied all wing units at Khe Sanh together. Wire-laying parties were kept busy as the numerous incoming artillery, rocket, and mortar rounds continued to knock out wire circuits. Due to the continually increasing enemy pressure, defenses about the DASC, which is situated just 75 meters behind the perimeter, were planned and developed. Increased sandbag, wire, and fighting holes were included. During the early part of February, the DASC worked directly with the Air Force ABCCC. The ABCCC frequently passed targets to the DASC, which had been detected by Air Force recon planes employing various sensor systems. The time from detection to reporting to the DASC was usually about 15 minutes. These targets were considered very valid, and Air Force flights of 4 to 8 aircraft were passed to the DASC by the ABCCC for ASRAC control. As February advanced, the 26 Marines, whom we were supporting, began to generate some 40 to 50 high-priority targets of their own, and soon there were more targets than the ASRAC could handle. After a conference with the fire support coordinator, it was decided that the 26 Marines' targets would have priority and that only urgent targets passed by the ABCCC would come before the 26 Marines' targets. This appeared to straighten out the difficulty, and no further problems in this respect occurred. The ASRAT routine at night called for 2 Marine flights and 3 Air Force flights for a total of 5 each hour. In the event of a ground attack, all ABCCC assets would become available. On 18 February, in a 24-hour period, ASRAT Bravo controlled 99 missions involving over 275 aircraft. 486 tons of ordnance were delivered on 105 targets for a new squadron record. At the peak of activity, the ASRAT controlled 6 to 7 flights per hour. The ASRAT antenna radome received fragmentation damage on several occasions. However, the set was knocked off the air only once when a 122-millimeter rocket landed about 7 meters away. The set was operational 20 minutes later. Period 4 to 25 February was marked by low ceilings, continuous fog, and overcast. Air Force C-130 aircraft started making pair drops of supplies. These drops were not always successful due to the weather, and some supplies were not being recovered. The Air Force then asked for ASRAT assistance, and beginning 20 February, our ASRAT controlled pair drop missions for this. In addition, the ASRAT provided GCA assistance to C-123s and other aircraft, bringing them to uneventful landings. The only disadvantage in the operation, from our point of view, was that the ASRAT was diverted from its primary mission for several hours. As February progressed, it began to be suspected that close air support strikes using 250-pound bombs and napalm were not being as effective as desired. The Arvin Ranger Battalion commander was contacted, and he pointed out a particular enemy bunker area about 900 meters out that had received TPQ-10 strikes with little effect. The TADC was then asked to provide bombs of at least 750 pounds or heavier with delay fuses set at 0.025 seconds. A TPQ drop was made on the bunker target, and the Arvin listening post, which was sent out immediately after, reported excellent results and that we had finally begun to crack or cave in these bunkers. TADC was then requested to schedule all daytime TPQ aircraft with bombs of 750 pounds or more and armed with delay fuses. By the end of the month, all TPQ drops were requested with this ordnance. Most TPQ targets in the Khe Sanh area were well dug in and bunkered artillery, rocket, and mortar positions, and larger bombs with delay fuses greatly increased the effectiveness of our TPQ strikes. control of helicopters presented a difficult problem. Upon the arrival of the DASC, the 26 Marines had a direct unit support package of two UH-1Es, two CH-46s, and two UH-34 aircraft, the primary mission being resupply and medevac for the hill positions. The 26 Marines ALO was coordinating these missions. The increasing tempo of operations and increased enemy fire had begun to reduce effectiveness of control due to limited communication facilities and personnel. Accordingly, the DASC asked for and assumed helicopter control responsibility. The Huey gunships had begun to lose effectiveness in the fire suppression role as enemy activity increased. Helicopters landing on the hill positions were receiving mortar, automatic, and small arms fire. In addition, entry and exit routes were covered by 50 caliber machine gun fire. The DASC therefore assigned airborne FACs and fixed wing aircraft to assist in fire suppression, and with this, aid the first successful resupply hill of 881 South in 6 days, it was accomplished. Meanwhile, the NVA had moved in close to the perimeter, and airfield operations became increasingly hazardous. Losses of helicopters staying overnight at Quezon began to increase, and the practice was abandoned. Refueling, loading, and unloading of both fixed-wing and helicopter aircraft came under fire. A fire suppression plan was developed by 1st Marine Air Wing, and the DASC assisted in coordination of fixed-wing, helicopter, and TACA aircraft. Upon execution, it appears that the threat somewhat diminished. It's noted that the most effective fire suppressor employed appeared to be chemical smoke. On 25 February, the DASC bunker withstood a direct hit from a 122-millimeter point detonating rocket. This event encouraged a further increase in layers of sandbags and other material on the bunker. In March, activity at Quezon continued at a fast pace. NVA artillery, rockets, and mortars continued to pound the 26th Marines perimeter, while the relatively good weather throughout the month allowed U.S. air power to pound the NVA. Midway through the month, ASRAT Bravo began to experience maintenance problems due to the shock of repeated near misses at the site. Similar problems with radio antennas were experienced throughout the month at both DASC and ASRAT sites. However, none of these problems shut down operations except for brief periods. Of particular interest was the shelling experienced on 17 March. That day, the DASC bunker took three direct hits, one of which ripped open the overhead of the entrance passageway. Another of those hits damaged the DASC generator. During the same attack, the communications bunker took a direct hit, and an MRC-87 parked outside was destroyed, also by a direct hit. On 7 March, a single manager concept was introduced, which placed some 1st Marine Air Wing assets under control of 7th Air Force. As a result, the Da Nang DASC became subordinate to IDASC, and the Quezon DASC became subordinate to DASC Victor. This realignment usurped many of the functions that Marine DASCs had customarily performed. As March drew to a close, the normal control and coordination problems arising from the alignment, from the realignment, were being worked out, though not to everyone's satisfaction. On 27 March, the squadron fielded a detachment to augment 1st Air Cavalry Division headquarters, Air Liaison Office, for Operation Pegasus. The purpose of this operation was to lift the siege of Quezon. With the success of Pegasus, by early April, the DASC and ASRAT operations eased off considerably. Although the DASC has been vital in the defense of Quezon, the situation there in January, February, and March was made for ASRAT operations. Surrounded and totally dependent on supporting arms for survival, some artillery fires were provided from Camp Carroll and the rock pile, and artillery was used both from the Quezon combat base and the outlying hills that we controlled. However, the Quezon artillery was entirely dependent on helicopters and paratroops for resupply. With the weather as it was, the helos and transports could not always make it. Thus, the major supporting arm was air. Again, because of the weather, visual control was not always possible. Therefore, the ASRAT was used to the maximum right from the start. Conducting close to 100 missions a day, this is about the busiest that an ASRAT can be expected to be on a sustained basis. This means operating about 23 hours a day, being shut down for about an hour a day each day for maintenance. Included in the ASRAT activities at Quezon was the TPQ-controlled bomb dropping of napalm at night. I believe this was the first attempt at this. There are no bomb tables for napalm at the altitudes at which we control, so we had to test drop a few times in daytime using an estimated trail and time of fall and being corrected by a spotter. The napalm containers did not tumble or float as much as we had feared, and after four drops, we were within 50 meters, so we used it several times at night. This would appear to be a fearsome weapon at night, coming as it does without any warning. Furthermore, if a ballistic container were developed, greater accuracy and greater confidence should result. One final comment on ASRAT operations. Because of the proximity of the enemy to our positions, we made drops closer to our lines than we normally would. We have successfully dropped as close as 200 meters from friendly lines. A recurring problem was maintenance of generators. The isolation of caisson, the frequent inability of helicopters to land with repair parts, and the hazards of the continued incoming artillery, rocket, mortar, and small arms all brought into sharp focus the necessity of the individual responsible for maintenance being well trained. In Mass 3's case, we haven't had a 1342 on board for 6 months. Therefore, at caisson, we used 1341s who were not well trained in the electrical systems of generators and 1141s, electricians. We were able to accomplish our mission, but this was possible through the use of generators owned by other Marine and Air Force units at caisson and by the fact that caisson enjoyed the highest priority in the area of logistic support and courier transportation. Nevertheless, it would have been much easier had we had at least one experienced 1342 to diagnose and repair generators.
Following is the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing taped historical interview. The interviewee is Sergeant Edward E. Brown, 2061334, USMC. Aviation Electronics Operator, attached to MAS-3 at Chu Lai in the Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Sergeant K.L. Anderson, 2131738, USMC. This interview takes place at Chu Lai in the Republic of Vietnam on 13 May 1968. The subject of this interview is observations with MAS-3 in caisson occurring 21 January 68 through 11 March 68. This interview is classified secret until downgraded by higher authority.
Like the Sergeant Anderson said, I arrived in caisson on January the 21st, and as we moved in there by helicopter, and we were hovering over the ground a little while, I don't know, I guess the pilots were waiting to see if they were having an incoming. I guess they had prior to that morning, as when they'd hit the bomb dump there, but there was still a lot of smoke coming up from the ground. And we landed. It was around the evening at that time, and they had a blackout. It's the first time I'd ever seen anything where a base was on a total blackout after darkness. We moved over to the ASRAT, as the DASC hadn't been set up as yet that night. And during that course of the evening, they took in a few incoming rounds, but it still sounded like outgoing to me because of the batteries that were so close to us. And the following day, we started working on setting up the DASC. And it took us about 2 days before we could get it set up. All this time we were taking incoming. And myself, I've been in country for 20, I'm working on my 20th month this month. And it was the first time I'd ever been subjected in a hostile action this close to any section I've been attached to. And to say the least, it was a surprise to myself, and I know a lot of others. We had set up the DASC on January the 24th, and we were operating pretty smoothly, as could be expected from just a short notice. And about 5:30 in the afternoon, they had a barrage here. It lasted about 3 hours. Later found out that the shellings were coming from the Laotian border and just west of that, off of Highway 9. And it was around 8:30 before that quit. When they first started hitting, a lot of people were still not used to incoming and outgoing, and some of them thought it was still outgoing and didn't hesitate to move. But myself, I didn't want to wager the difference, and I just made it on out of there while I left my captain and a few other officers still standing at the helm. The reason I left was because we didn't have a ceiling over our heads, and they were still thinking it was outgoing shells. But about a few minutes after I left, they came scampering back in this one little bunker that we'd had set up at the time, and they were believers also. Things were pretty hard on as far as work-wise went. We'd have to work about all 12 hours in our DASC, and as soon as we got off work, we'd have to work about 6 hours filling sandbags and everything. and we were operating out of this infirmary that was from the concussion of the bomb dump that blew about 4 days prior, had knocked the roofs in and some of the walls in. So we were just building more or less around that, trying to make it a little bit more secure. And then the Air Force was getting ready to give away a bunker. I mean, not give it away. The 1st Marine, 26 Marines were going to be needing a bunker, but this Air Force officer, it was the liaison officer up there for the 20th TAS, had suggested giving it to us since we didn't have any place to stay and our gear was highly technical and a lot of cost involved in it. So we moved over there shortly after that. And I think it was around the 1st of March that we moved over to the 20th TAS building. We worked in conjunction with them. And as expected for the Air Force, they had better equipment than what we did. And we found ourselves many a time having to use their equipment, which helped us out a great deal. It was around 1st of March when we got everything pretty well coordinated. At first there, where there was a lot of bickering between controlling of targets, whose target had priority, the 7th Air Force or 26 Marines, and who we were support of. And after a brief conference with our higher officers, they'd gotten this settled, and 26 Marines had won the battle. All through this month, the incoming was sporadic, anywhere from 300 rounds a day up to as much as 1,300 in one day. And to go anywhere was taking the risk of your life any time. And most of the people were pretty aware of that, and they didn't make too many extra trips more than necessary. One time, when I was getting ready to leave there, I'd gone down to the airfield just to see if my relief was coming in. And while I went there, most of the people were standing out right across from Charlie Med to be medevaced out that they would hit. And myself, I didn't feel like standing up there, so I went down into a lower bunker right along the airstrip. And as sure as the 34 came in to pick up these passengers, a couple of rounds were thrown in right on the pad. And I went out about 10 minutes later, and there were all kinds of helmets and rifles laying out there where they were all standing around, and blood spots and stuff like this. And there was around 3 killed and about 15 or 16 injured. And these were guys who were hit day prior or 2 days prior or something like that. They couldn't get out. But they were pretty well isolated up there. The weather was really bad up until about 1100 or 12 o'clock each day. It would be just a complete fog bank, and it wouldn't lift around those times. And so it made it kind of tough on everything. Mail was a big problem also. We'd go 30 days without any mail at a time. And that didn't boost the morale factor too much, and not hearing from your loved ones or anything like this. It was sort of depressing. You never knew if you was going to get out of there alive, and you don't know if your mail got out yourself. I know a couple instances I'd sent mail out that the people never received, probably due to some of the cargo ships that were hit as they left Quezon and crashed about 5 miles outside of there. But I don't know the real story on that, but mail was a big factor up there that it could have been increased better. I noticed all through the time we was up at Quezon, though we had to eat sea rats, say 95% of the time, though we were living with the Air Force, and this one officer there was in charge here. He had ran a restaurant on the outside, and he had his hot meals, I'd say, about 2 to 3 days out of the week. He'd try and do his best, and we all greatly appreciated this. Though, one thing about the morale factor, during the daytime, the morale, I'd say, was pretty well up there. Most of the guys, we joke about stuff, and I noticed this around the whole Quezon area, that they didn't lose their sense of humor. I don't know how it was at night myself. When I'm alone at night, I felt pretty much insecure. But during the daytime, everybody was trying to keep each other happy and keep the morale up. I don't think we had any cases of anybody cracking up or really disturbed about the whole matter. And all I can say about my time up there at Quezon was that it was an experience I'll never forget. Thank you.